From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Great to have you with us today. There are nearly 2,500 active COVID-19 cases in California prisons, with more than 30 deaths related to the outbreak. Some say overcrowding and inmate transfers are responsible for the recent spike in cases. Joining us to help explain the situation is Kate Irby from Washington, D.C. She's McClatchy's California congressional reporter. And welcome, Kate.
Hi, Randall.
And so how bad is this outbreak? Is the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation getting any kind of a handle on it?
So it's unclear right now. They obviously have to release more prisoners, which they're doing now, hopefully to get more of a handle on this. You have a lot of advocates for prisoners saying that that's the main way you can actually cut down on cases within prisons, because otherwise, if you just lock them down, it just tends to circulate the virus around the prison, and it's pretty much, and you can't socially distance when you already have these prisons filled to capacity.
And this prison release plan is controversial, I guess, to say the least. It's really polarizing for some people who say, you know, some say it's absolutely necessary. Others say, what are you thinking?
Sure. So, and you have kind of this balance you have to strike, even according to advocates for prisoners who say, you know, we don't need to release maybe people who have, you know, sexual based crimes or murder, but we need to talk about who we are comfortable releasing to these home release programs, because otherwise we could be sentencing people to get coronavirus and possibly die from that. So it's a tricky issue that you have to kind of figure out what the right balance is.
And these prisoners that would be released, they are prisoners that have tested positive for COVID-19, or there's another metric for figuring out which people leave?
So I mostly cover federal prisons, so I'm not totally sure on that. I don't want to speak where I don't have good knowledge. So
okay, no, that's great. And I will say that Governor Newsom has announced that as many as 8,000 prisoners would be released by the end of next month, by the end of August. You have covered, Kate, a problem with air conditioning at least one prison in California. Talk up a little bit about that.
Right. So the federal prison in Mendota, which is just west of Fresno, they have had their air conditioning going down for years. They just put prisoners back in March in order to try to socially distance prisoners so they could cut down on coronavirus into this unit, this housing unit that hadn't been used very much previously because there were air conditioning issues. Of course, the problem was they didn't fully fix the air conditioning issues, according to staff that I talked to. So it had been going out every once in a while, sometimes for days at a time. You guys know how hot it gets there. We're looking at 100 degrees when prisoners are confined to their cells for 24 hours a day as another thing to try to combat coronavirus. And now to add to that, you have positive cases within that prison. The Bureau of Prison has only confirmed 3 staff cases and 1 inmate case so far. I've talked to some people at the prison who say that number is actually higher right now, but they're not sure confirmed how high that's going to be. So it's really a bad issue down there right now, because once you start getting cases in prisons, just like we talked about, it's very hard to stop it from spreading.
And the union that represents the workers there at that union, they've taken their grievances directly to the department, the mm-hmm. Federal Department of Justice?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what are they saying? That it's causing a danger for them?
Yeah, I mean, they feel it causes a danger for inmates and for them with this air conditioning issue and the coronavirus issue. Because just think about it from a normal human perspective. You know, people get really hot and they get irritated more easily. When you're in close quarters with people, you can't move, you can't do anything all day, you get irritated easily. And it can cause confrontations, which can be dangerous to both inmates and staff. So they're really concerned, and their reports have so far, they say, have gone kind of unheeded, and there hasn't been a lot of accountability. And so they're really worried, and they're also worried they're getting retaliated against for making these reports instead of having these issues dealt with.
All right. Kate, I'd want to shift a little away from prisons, if that's okay, for a moment, and ask you about a second round of possible stimulus checks.
Of course.
Yeah.
So where we're standing right now, which you never know with Congress, they are trying to get something done by the end of the month. And it seems everybody is interested in passing something. So we're still not sure exactly what that's going to be. Democrats tend to want it to be more, like $3 trillion, like what they passed earlier this year, but the Senate didn't take it up. And McConnell over in the Senate seems to want to keep things down to $1 trillion, which people say could be a bit of a struggle. So the two main issues we've heard from readers that people are really interested in are these stimulus payments, $1,200 check that most people got sometime back in April or May, and then the increased unemployment, which was another $600 per week for people who are on unemployment. So the unemployment lapses at the end of July, that increase in payment, and Democrats want to extend it. They wanted to do it until the end of 2020, until 2021. Republicans are not as big of a fan of that idea, so we're going to see how that one plays out. And then the stimulus payments, it seems everybody is kind of on board for a stimulus payment, but it still hasn't come exactly together. And McConnell has kind of floated this idea that maybe people who make $40,000 and less instead of $75,000 and less should get these stimulus payments instead. But even that's not concrete. We just know that's something he's kind of floated in the public eye.
So it would shrink dramatically the number of people that receive checks if,
correct.
Yeah, so, if that were to be tacked on.
Correct.
We're starting to see a little more acceptance of mask wearing among leaders in Washington. What are you hearing along those lines?
So it seems like it has kind of trended that way. We know that President Donald Trump has kind of said, you know, the other day, you know, oh, I look good in a mask. Like, it makes me look presidential, people are saying. So you've seen Republican commentator figureheads like Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham come out and say, like, wear a mask. There's nothing wrong with wearing a mask. I don't know how much that shifted public opinion on mask wearing. I haven't seen poll numbers on that. But hopefully people are more on board with wearing masks if they see leaders doing so.
And Mitch McConnell has come out supporting masks as well. At first, it sounded to go at odds with the president for a moment, which you don't hear often.
But now it seems like people are kind of all on the same page. They're trying to not make it a partisan issue, which is what people were really afraid it was turning into. So hopefully we see that trend back.
It's summertime. Anything to look forward to in the week ahead here in the nation's capital?
I mean, they're still talking about, like I said, this coronavirus stimulus package. We're hoping that we'll see more concrete movement on that. Everything has been happening behind closed doors right now, but it does seem like everyone's interested in getting something through, and they can always give themselves more time to work on that if they need to. But right now the deadline is kind of end of July, which is when those unemployment benefits lapse, and usually Congress goes on a recess for all of August. So,
all right, Kate Irby, McClatchy's California congressional reporter, on the state of COVID-19 in prisons here in the state and several other topics as well. Kate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Randall.
And of course, you are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. A new federal order says international students at the nation's colleges and universities must take at least one in-person class or go home. Sacramento State President Dr. Robert Nelson joins us now to talk about that order and how it would affect his campus and how he plans to deal with it. Welcome to Insight, President Nelson.
Good morning, Randall. How are you?
I appreciate having you here today. You issued a letter to students back on Friday where you said the order is forcing Sac State to abandon its responsibility for the health and safety of the student body. Can you explain that a bit?
We're going to have to provide classes for our students. At this point, we are virtual. This summer, we're 100% virtual. In the fall, we will only have 5% of our total sections, and we usually have 6,000 sections of courses. And that's been for the safety of our students and the like. We would like to keep as many people as we can virtual and learning in a virtual environment, but this order will force us to help our international students find a course so that they can remain here. Many of those students would not be able to even return to their country because the country is not accepting people from the United States or people who have been here.
Right.
So it is a very serious problem that we're dealing with.
If I remember correctly, Sac State was among the first CSU campuses to announce it was going entirely virtual, wasn't it?
We were one of the first, yes.
Yeah. And so how is that going so far?
Amazingly well. We graduated 9,778 students just a few weeks ago. When we were going through all of this, we were worried as we pivoted to virtual that our students would not do well and they would drop out. Only 70 students dropped out. That's just a remarkable number because wow. usually it's many, many more than that in the hundreds. So our students were resilient and our faculty were just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of this international, the order for international students, you say it's getting more confusing as time passes. You were hoping to have sort of a solid look at it and what the campus planned to do, but I guess the rules keep changing?
Well, the initial order said one thing, and then the FAQs that came out said something different. The FAQs allowed us to have what's called a hybrid courses, where students will come to campus part-time and be virtual part-time. So that's what we're planning on doing. You'll have a class that will be, let's say it's a business, international business class, and you'll have 50 students in there. You'll have 20% of the students come on Monday, 20% come on Wednesday, 20% come on Friday, and then the remainder, and you'll rotate it that way. So you don't have, you can maintain the social distancing and yet still give the education. And then you'll be filming the course as it's ongoing. So the students that are not there in the classroom will be able to watch.
Ah, I see. Okay. And in terms of just the Sac State campus, we're looking at as many as 400 international students that could be affected by this order?
Almost 500.
Oh, almost 500. Uh-huh. Where do most of the students come from, the international students come from?
They come from all over the world. A lot of students come from China. A lot of students come from Vietnam. We have a high number of students who come from the Middle East as well. I remember when I first came here and I started doing stingers up to everybody, this young man from Turkey coming to me and saying, "I don't know what it means, but it really feels good."
You're really proud of the diversity at Sac State, and I imagine that the international student body really adds to that.
I was a professor for many, many years. And when I had an international student in my class, I was a better professor.
Oh, how
because
so?
I could draw on that student's perspective, and my students would see something different. And I had to make sure that I was clear and concise and that I was communicating it to my very best. So that diversity really helped me be a better teacher, but it also helped everyone in that class who got to see a new perspective be a better student.
President Nelson, we're seeing reports of, I guess, some creative workarounds for this international student order. Some U.S.-based students are saying that they'll give up their seats for in-person classes so that international students can take those classes and not be sent home. Are you witnessing that on the Sac State campus, or have you heard of any other sort of creative workarounds within the student body?
I have heard of that on campus because our students care and they want to make it happen. So with the 5% of the 6,000 courses, we've got a lot of courses that are going to be available for these students. I'm confident we'll be able to do it. I've been just very, very pleased and very, very proud at how many faculty members have contacted me and said, "I'm willing to come back to campus" for them.
What's the best case scenario moving forward with this?
That there'll be a court injunction that will take this case off this whole thing away. I think that's highly likely with Harvard and the MIT lawsuit that's taking place right now. The judge has said that she wants to make a decision very quickly by the middle of this week, because we're only 6 to 8 weeks away from classes starting. These students need to know where they need to be, and they need to know what their future is.
President Nelson, you mentioned the upcoming fall semester. Are there any plans to rework the student fees and those sorts of costs that are passed on to students? There's been some grumbling among different sectors of the student body that say because it's mostly an online experience now, that a lot of the fees that they're paying don't make sense anymore, and they're being charged for attending a campus that doesn't really exist.
There's a basic misunderstanding about fees. First and foremost, 79% of my budget goes to pay for faculty and staff to work here. So there isn't a lot of money that's going to fees in that way. So the tuition is actually paying for the instruction the students are getting. A lot of students believe that, for instance, the Well, which is the rec center, and say that I'm not able to go to the rec center anymore because it's closed, therefore I shouldn't pay the rec fee, the Well fee. Well, the Well fee isn't really it's not like a fee that you have to attend a fitness center, okay? You're paying for services there. The Well fee is just like is paying for debt service. It's just like paying on the mortgage. The students, when they decided they wanted to have the Well, decided that they would have a fee to be able to pay for the building and pay for the mortgage. So the money goes there. The reality is, I think that the Well will be open. The health services are open. We're seeing several hundred students attend and go to the health services right now. And with the COVID-19 situation, we'll be able to do testing there. We'll be able to do contact tracing. So all of that's still up and running. And many of the other services are still up and running. The one question that we have is athletics, and we don't know where we will be there. We're waiting for the governor's order to be able to decide where we'll move forward on that front.
President Nelson, do I understand that there might be the ability to bring some students into the dorms where it's one student per dorm as opposed to two?
Yes, we will have 1,000 students on campus in the dorms at this point. And we have over 2,300 students that have applied for those positions. They want to be there, but we will have single occupancy and they will be able to come in. We've worked out how they'll get in and out and how they'll use the bathrooms and everything else. It'll be a safe environment for them.
Many of us who, you know, went to college and went to dorms can't imagine having the luxury of that much space in a dorm setting. The economies of scale are completely out the window. The university can afford to do this sort of setup?
It's going to be difficult, but we'll make it through. Okay. We are using all of our reserves to move forward. I was just in a meeting and came out of that meeting where we're going through the budget right now to figure out how we'll make it work.
All right. Sacramento State President Dr. Robert Nelson, his views on a new federal order to force international students to take at least one in-person class or go back home, and how his campus is planning to deal with that and all the other new realities, I guess, created by COVID-19. President Nelson, thank you so much for taking time this morning.
Thank you, Randall.
And up next, COVID-19 is dramatically affecting the Sacramento region. We'll speak with the person who led a new study by Cap Radio and Valley Vision and dive deep into reporting on how the pandemic is hitting some communities harder than others. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Evan Schmidt is CEO of Valley Vision, a Sacramento-based research organization which partnered with Cap Radio to survey the region about the impact of COVID-19. And the survey was also conducted with the help of the Institute for Social Research at Sacramento State. And Cap Radio news reporter Sarah Mises-Tan also dug into the information. Her new piece is on Black and Latino workers' fear of being infected with COVID-19 on the job. We have Evan Schmidt and Sarah Mises-Tan with us today. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Randall.
Thank you.
Yes. So, Evan, I'm going to start with you. Why did you decide to do this survey with CAP Radio? How did that all work out?
Yeah, well, we have been doing surveys for the last 3 years. This is our sixth public opinion survey that we've done. And we found CAP Radio to be really the perfect partner for this survey. You know, I think our goal is really to gather unique data from across the region about people's views, their experiences, and their perceptions about some of the issues that are impacting them the most. So when I think of CAP Radio's goals of sharing stories about all of us across the region, I just think it was the perfect pairing, and it really allows the data that we've uncovered to be shared widely and to dive in deep on the really human stories that are a part of that survey. And I think, you know, we were just really excited about the partnership.
This was exclusively Sacramento County?
Nope, this was a regional survey. So it was Sacramento, Yolo County, Yuba and Sutter Counties, El Dorado, Placer County, Solano, and San Joaquin.
So a real good snapshot of the CAP Radio footprint as well. So Evan, let's talk a little bit about some of the main takeaways for you. What did we learn through this research?
Yeah, well, it's not a surprise to anybody, I think, to say that people are very tuned into this. They're very concerned about it, and they've been deeply impacted by COVID-19 and by shelter in place. One thing I'll note is that this survey was out in the field between May 12th to May 27th. And so when you think about where we were at that time, we had just been in kind of more extreme lockdown from shelter in place. We were just coming into phase two and starting to reopen a little bit at that point. And so everything about shelter in place and about the risk of infection of COVID-19 was very deeply on people's minds. One thing that we uncovered in the survey is that there are some disparities across our population around what people's experiences were and what their concerns were. A lot of these disparities came through racial and ethnic lines. And so when you looked at levels of concerns about contracting COVID-19, about caring for loved ones and other concerns about health risks, we saw African-American respondents much more concerned. We saw African-American and Hispanic respondents more concerned about getting it on the job. And then when we asked questions about social and emotional health, so depression, anxiety, feelings of hopelessness, concerns about substance abuse, concerns about the well-being of children in the household, we saw levels of depression, concerns about substance abuse, much higher for African Americans as well as Hispanic respondents, as well as younger respondents in that case. So, you know, one of our takeaways from this is that people are really experiencing the pandemic differently according to who you are in the region.
And this is the most comprehensive study of its kind for the region that we've seen yet, right? From any type of organization, even governmental.
Yes, I think that when you look at, so we have a margin of error plus or minus 3%. So there's a lot of surveys that are out there that are surveying statewide or nationwide. But this survey is specific to our region. It's a deep dive into our communities and the populations in our region in a unique way that hasn't been done before.
And you mentioned the disparity with communities of color. That's where I want to bring in reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, this was your exact area of focus, right?
Yeah. And so my reporting essentially mostly focused on a lot of those disparities that Evan mentioned, the fact that in certain markers that showed economic distress and emotional distress, both African-American and Latino workers were more likely to have said things like they were having trouble during the pandemic. So things like concern over getting COVID on the job, like Evan mentioned, concern over losing their job, reporting feelings of depression or anxiety, all of these, you saw at much higher rates within these two groups. Here's Alfred Lewis Walker II. He's a casino worker near Sacramento.
So many Latino and African-American people, they work because they're trying to sustain their families and keep themselves whole. And for so many people, it's sad to say this, like they are living check to check. So to miss a check, it's meaningful. Miss a day is meaningful. You know, it means something. It means whether or not they're going to put food on the table, you know. And it's like so many different problems that we face as a community as a whole, you know.
Yeah. Wow, Sarah. I mean, we come into work here at CAP Radio and we're really distanced. You know, you've been working from home and we do what we can to, you know, keep everyone apart. I cannot imagine going to work at a casino of all places. I can understand why there might be a higher level of anxiety there.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion just around like how often they're able to access personal protective equipment also, and just how often they're even given breaks to wash their hands or sanitize their workstations. So these are all kind of larger issues.
Right, right. Was there anything that really stood out and surprised you?
Well, I think as a lot of things that we see as a result of the COVID pandemic, the issue is more that just COVID has exacerbated pre-existing issues. So with racial disparities that we're seeing in emotional and financial well-being during this lockdown, these are in some ways not that surprising to some of the experts I spoke with. Christina Mora, for example, she's a professor of sociology and the co-director of the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. Here she is.
If you look at the distribution of where people work, that sort of the poor would be less able and communities of color would be less able to work safely from home. The Black and especially Latinx communities in California and the way that they are much more likely to be represented in retail or essential retail and many of these essential services that are non-medical and thus are much more exposed to catching COVID. For example, of the high rates of COVID in agricultural fields.
Mm-hmm. We've heard that from over the last several months, how and also like the transportation from one farm to the next or from the living quarters is often, you know, in a packed situation where social distancing just isn't possible.
Yeah. And, you know, we're seeing, I spoke with a representative for farm workers who's been overseeing some of their conditions. I think there are a number of workers unions that have basically been fighting for better working conditions for essential workers like the casino worker that you heard from, retail and hospitality workers, and then, of course, farm workers. They're asking for things like personal protective equipment to be regularly distributed, for mask wearing to be enforced, and in some cases for the right to refuse to work and still be able to return to their specific job position if they deem their workplace unsafe. Mm. So for farm workers in particular, you know, the situation is especially tricky. It's a field that experts say is nearly 100% Latinx with a high percentage of undocumented immigrants. So this group already had less of a voice in terms of working conditions and access to healthcare. And yet now we're really seeing how much we rely on this group to continue working for the rest of us to feel sustained. So here's Juanita Ontiveros. She's a legal observer with the California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation. She goes out to distribute education materials to workers in the fields and to also check in on the conditions they're working with.
The farm workers were declared essential workers. And they keep saying it's a pretty word, but you can't do too much with that. They want a protection more than anything. They want to feel secure at their work.
Yeah, I mean, that pretty much says it there. And Sarah, this isn't the end of your reporting on this. You have several stories coming up in the days and I would imagine even weeks to come.
Yeah. We are working on breaking down a few other points from this data into a couple other points. We'll be looking at Asian Americans and how they've experienced the pandemic as well. That's coming out tomorrow. And we will also be looking at what the results show in terms of white people and white privilege.
All right. CAP Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan with her new reporting. It's all part of this collaboration between Valley Vision and Capital Public Radio, also with some help from Sacramento State. It's the most comprehensive survey of how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected the Sacramento region. And here to tell us about it is Sarah, who you just heard from, and also Evan Schmidt. She is the CEO of Valley Vision. And Evan, I'm wondering, this information that we've gathered, I put myself in that, I guess. How can it be used to improve the situation for those that are most impacted by COVID-19?
Yeah, that's a great question. I always think of these surveys as the beginning of a conversation. And so anytime that you're able to really illuminate what people's experiences are, what their pain points are, you're able through a survey like this to look at these big trends. So we might hear stories or read the national news that there's disparities, but when you see that reflected in the numbers in our communities, I mean, it's really in all of our communities across the entire region, then it drives it home in a new way. And so as we're sharing this data, as we're able to share these kind of big picture trends of experiences that we're seeing, we'll be talking with decision makers. We share these findings with decision makers across the region in order to inform policies, programs, and investments, and really drive home that point that there are people who really need help on the ground, and what can we do to make sure that that we're taking care.
Evan, how did you decide which questions to ask?
Well, when we started putting this survey together, I think we started in April. I will say that oftentimes we draw from other surveys across the nation, but because COVID-19 was so new, we didn't have that many surveys to draw
There's
from.
There's nothing to lean on, right?
Yeah. And so we have an advisory committee made up of board members and other experts in the community. So we really lean on those people to help us really track what are the types of issues that we should be asking questions about. The Institute for Social Research at Sacramento State, they provide a lot of expertise into how do you ask survey questions that to reduce bias and to get the
right.
to get the information that you're looking for. And so we really, zeroed in on, we want to know about people's experiences. We know there's going to be health impacts. We know there's going to be economic impacts. And we also talked about people's perceptions about COVID-19. And we saw some polarized views there across the political lens. And so we were able to really have a wide range of the types of questions that we were asking. And a lot of people to help us kind of formulate those as we were working so early in the pandemic. We are happy that we are going to be able to repeat this survey again. So we're planning on doing it at least two more times over the next 9 months or so. And that's going to allow us to really understand the trends. And so we can repeat questions so we can see how it changes over time. But then we can also ask new questions reflecting the reality as we're experiencing it right now.
How do you even conduct a survey in the era of COVID-19? And I ask that because, if it's entirely by phone, there are some communities where access to a phone is just not there. So are they left out?
Well, the methodology that we use is we draw from a panel. So this is a panel of over 2,000 people that are demographically representative of the region as a whole. And we get this panel by sending out a postcard to over 100,000 people across the region, and they get to opt in to participating in surveys, but they don't have a particular topic that they're responding to. They're really just agreeing to respond to surveys as part of wide-ranging research. We offer an incentive for their time, so they get a $5 gift card if they would like whenever they take a survey. We think that's a good strategy to be able to make it accessible for people. It's available in Spanish as well, and it is an online survey, but you can get it as a paper survey as well. So we really do our best through a wide-ranging outreach to be able to make it accessible for people and to really achieve a demographically representative sample of our region's population.
For this particular survey, is it just not possible to include the homeless population, or was there an effort to include that as well?
It is, because it's grounded to a physical address, it is not highly possible to include the homeless population.
Are there aspects of that that because that population is not included, that you feel the survey is lacking or missing in those areas?
I think dealing with the issue of homelessness and COVID-19 is a really serious issue with very specific considerations about how to make sure that population is safe during this time. So I don't think this survey really speaks to that, but I do think that it's an area that that needs attention, and that gathering more information about what are the needs of homeless people, during this time would be very valuable.
You talked about, you know, bringing this information to decision makers. I imagine that would be like politicians and mayors and those sorts of people. What are you hoping that they will change, or that, like, what, you know, if you have a meeting, it's an action item. what's the action item for the decision makers? What can they change based on this information?
Well, I think decision makers are directing a lot of dollars right now. And so having fact-based data to understand where we might need those investments most, I think would be really important. So looking, for example, at these issues of disparities, really, really targeting how will we help support communities of color in the region. I think that's incredibly important. I think other decision makers are community-based organizations who are poised to be able to provide programs and provide help for people. So I think this survey would be of great interest to them as we're deployed in our communities trying to ease people's pain, pain and suffering.
What sort of question, you mentioned future surveys, what sort of questions do you feel would be added moving forward that you didn't ask this time around and thought, we need to tack that on, you know, would we ask the next time?
I think, you know, like I said, this survey was so early. It was very oriented towards shelter in place and kind of the most extreme version of our shelter in place. I think now, as we're looking at opening up more, I want to continue to ask questions about people's perceptions about that. I think getting redeployed at work, so things about job training, going back to work, I think zeroing in on some of these disparity issues and trying to understand where there might be potential for action and what people's perceptions are about how to move forward, I think would be really important as well.
And I, you know, we still have Sarah Mises-Tan on the line who's doing reporting based on this survey. I imagine Valley Vision could maybe take some feedback from the reporters that are going out and using this information. Sarah, as you've been reporting on this, was there anything that you thought, wow, it would have been great if we knew, you know, XYZ?
Totally. Yeah. I think, you know, I think the survey is super comprehensive, which is really nice. I think one thing that we were curious about for the future was seeing some sort of like geographic breakdown. I know that that's something that Evan, you and I have talked about, and I don't know how possible it is, but I know that that's one question that myself and our data team had been curious about, is if we could map any of these responses to any like particular neighborhoods or areas in Sacramento. And I was also just personally curious, one of the people who I was speaking with at Berkeley had mentioned this, just some sort of breakdown within some groups, such as looking at, you know, I think overall this survey shows that conservatives answer in a very particular way, or, you know, they're less concerned about COVID or something like that than Democrats maybe. But within that subgroup, I was curious to see if we could break that out and see, well, of people who are white, Republicans, how many of them are expressing a certain level of concern versus people who are Black Republicans, Asian Republicans, Latinx Republicans? What does that difference look like, even controlling for that subgroup? I think that's something I was kind of interested to hear a little more about and would be great to see more in the future.
Merging the racial lines with the political lines.
Yeah, a little bit of that, or, you know, even looking at, there's a great economic breakdown where we look at people in different categories of salary, but, you know, it'd be great to see, like, that breakdown of, you know, what percentage of people in a certain salary group are African-American, Latino, Asian, white, and then within that, you know, that salary group may respond in a certain way, but, like, within that, like, what percentage responds, like, are there subtle differences in the way that even white people who may be low income or high income are responding versus the way that Black people who are high income or low income are responding?
Right. And Evan, I imagine you're going to take all that and go, you know, tap into the minds at Sac State and formulate the next questions as we move forward and through the summer.
Absolutely. That's one of the great things about partnering with CAP Radio, because the journalists have a different lens than we do. And I just think we're going to learn so much about what Sarah was just talking about and really looking at it from a different type of perspective than we usually do.
Yeah. Evan Schmidt, CEO of Valley Vision. That's a Sacramento-based research organization which partnered with CAP Radio to survey the region about the impact of COVID-19. And also CAP Radio news reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Her new piece is on Black and Latinx workers and their fear of being infected with COVID-19 on the job. We've talked about all of this information. It's available online at capradio.org, of course, and on the Valley Vision website. I imagine it's there as well, Evan?
Starting on Wednesday, it'll be available on the Valley Vision website, which is valleyvision.org.
All right, terrific. Hey, thanks to you both for that information. We're going to hear a lot more about this survey in the days to come, so we appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Randall.
So much for having me.
And stick with us, because just after the break, we are going to learn about America's first big entertainment superstar. She was a lesbian in the 1800s and didn't really hide it. She was incredibly popular, so much so that President Abraham Lincoln requested that she perform for him in Washington, D.C., and then she slid into complete obscurity. You probably don't know her name, but we're going to speak to the author of a new book about this Broadway powerhouse. That's coming up just after the break. I'm Randall White. This is Insight. Welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Writer, senior nonfiction editor of Guernica Magazine and New York University lecturer, Tana Wochuk is joining us right now. She's the author of the new book, Lady Romeo. It's the radical and revolutionary life of Charlotte Cushman, America's first celebrity. Yet, if you were asked earlier today, who's Charlotte Cushman, would you be able to respond? I'm guessing the majority of you would say no. And so we're going to find out from Tana why that is. Welcome to Insight. Great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
How did you discover Charlotte Cushman? What, you know, what led you to research her life in particular?
Yeah, I love Shakespeare, and I grew up treating it like popular entertainment at summer Shakespeare festivals. And found out about her as a woman who played men's roles like Hamlet and Romeo, and who was a huge, huge star in her time. And I wanted to know sort of how did she become a star and why don't we know about her now?
So she was doing gender-bending roles in the 1800s, and I can't imagine that that was in vogue at the time.
Yeah, when I discovered her story, I realized that there are all these people we know now who knew her and who celebrated her. But there were actually women who played men's roles pretty frequently, but it was done as more of a titillation. And she was a very convincing and attractive man on stage in how she performed. So it really challenged the way that I thought about the 19th century in America, too.
So the subtitle of your book is America's First Celebrity. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, so, you know, as you said, that Lincoln made her promise to play Lady Macbeth for him, which she did during the Civil War. Whitman called her a genius. Louisa May Alcott had a stage struck fit over her, and everyone from Dickens to Queen Victoria admired her work. So she was, again, like known as a very masculine actress, but also a very brilliant tragic actress.
Queen Victoria's admiration of her was a bit mixed, though, was it not?
Yes, it was. It was. Queen Victoria thought that she was not attractive enough to be fully admired, although she did think her Romeo was very good.
Well, Queen Victoria definitely had her opinions on how things looked.
Oh, yes.
So how large was Charlotte's influence on acting back then and then even today?
Yeah, I think she had a huge impact at the time. She supported a lot of young up-and-coming actresses. She also slept with many of them. I mean, it wasn't totally altruistic, I have to say. But she changed the way that we look at a lot of Shakespeare performances now. Romeo and Juliet woke up at the end of the play in the version that 19th century audiences used to see, and she brought back the original text. And she also helped us see Lady Macbeth as someone who was not a seductress, but the sort of powerhouse bully, kind of how we think of her now.
Your book starts at the end of her career with a performance in New York, and you're just so talented in the way that you bring people into the scene and paint a picture as the words are, you know, going past your eyes. I just enjoyed it a lot. And I'm wondering what made you start at the end?
Yeah, I didn't want to start with her death because it was too sad for me. I couldn't write that part till the end of the process, but I wanted to start with something that would show people how famous she was and how devastated people were when she left the stage, and how many people of all classes and demographics came out to support her when she quit the stage finally.
Right. So what was the most surprising thing that you learned in your research? So I imagine going into it, you had a pretty good sense of who this woman was. But as you start digging through things, did you go, whoa?
Yeah. She was a little bit of a Lothario for sure. She had played as one of her girlfriends actually said that she played Romeo to many Juliets. She did have a female partner named Emma Stebbins, who was actually the sculptor of the Bethesda Fountain in New York, and who, you know, Cushman was the model for that fountain. So it's sort of a secret memorial to her, which really shocked me. I used to spend a lot of time there. I had no idea.
Who, under your nose.
Standing over me.
Right. Right, exactly. Or above your nose, I guess, yeah.
That's right, yeah. There was a lot of ways that Cushman is actually in our culture. She helped when she first started, there was not much of an American culture to speak of, at least in terms of how Europe saw us. And by the time she died, we had all of these great writers and artists who we now know, but she was forgotten.
You know what I find most fascinating about this story is the way that her name faded. And there's some good reasons for that. And I want you to sort of walk through that process for us. How someone that was so big could become not a household name in such a short period of time.
Yeah. One of the reasons is just, theater itself is so hard to capture. Even today, if, we get Hamilton, that's great. But
right.
It's hard to capture the experience of being in a theater. And so as the people who saw her died, a lot of those memories died with them. But as a result, she's really dependent on the theater historians and biographers who come after her. And they were all Victorians, and they did not like the idea of a queer woman representing American culture. And she was written out.
Mm. And then, so many other media opportunities for entertainment came along, and really just the conversation just changed, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she herself said in her biography, her autobiography, she said, what can be the record of an actress, however famous?
Uh-huh.
It's very difficult to keep those. Now we have a lot of celebrities, and it's sort of the entertainment is very bifurcated. But at the time, really, there was theater and there was opera.
Right, right.
There was dramatic theater and then there was opera. That was basically it. So, certainly like the culture shifted as well.
So Charlotte's life was radical for the time on stage, but off stage as well?
Yeah, she, lived openly with female partners. She did move to Rome later in her life and establish an artist colony of women there. But she also, she dressed as a man offstage too. Whitman reported an article of her going out dressed, head to toe in men's clothing.
Uh-huh.
And he was delighted by this. He was so happy to report on this.
And was she doing it as a sense of drag, or was that was really more her persona?
I think that was her persona. I think actually the more feminized clothing and, you know, actions would have been more drag for her in many ways.
Right.
And it certainly, you know, she dressed as a man in that case to go riding on her horse because it was more comfortable. But I definitely get the sense that she thought of herself as a as more of a man. She refers to herself as a man in her letters.
Yeah,
pretty often. Yeah.
In just a few seconds, I'm sorry to give you such a short time for this, but how does her life story then build on the history of queerness in America?
Yeah, I think she is a networker extraordinaire. And if you look at Charlotte Cushman, it will lead you to so many other amazing queer artists who also deserve to be talked about and written about.
Yeah, excellent. Writer, senior nonfiction editor at Guernica Magazine, and New York University lecturer Tana Wojcik on her new book, Lady Romeo, The Radical and Revolutionary Life of Charlotte Cushman, America's First Celebrity. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And if you enjoyed any of the segments today or just want to learn more, head to capradio.org/insight. Hey, coming up today at noon, Cap Radio is hosting statewide coverage of California Governor Gavin Newsom's latest COVID-19 press conference. Be sure to join us during your lunch hour for that. I'm Randall White.